This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This month, to celebrate Asian Pacific Heritage Month in Asian Hosted Podcasts, we're bringing you an episode from They Call Us Bruce, one of our sister podcasts from the Potluck Podcast Collective. They Call Us Bruce is hosted by Asian American community mainstays Phil Yu, also known as the Angry Asian Man, and Jeff Yang, a prolific writer and celebrity dad, who, along with a guest or two, come together to discuss the good, the bad, and the WTF on the latest topics in Asian American culture and media. We've actually had the privilege of having Phil on this podcast, and Jeff's been a friend and supporter of Modern Minorities. On the episode we're featuring, Phil and Jeff are joined by Vivian Yoon, host and writer of the LAist podcast K-Pop Dreaming, to chat all about the rise of K-Pop and pop culture and to be nostalgic about the classics. Listen to They Call Us Bruce wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and you can learn more about They Call Us Bruce and our other Potluck podcasts by going to podcastpotluck.com. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to another edition of They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America. I'm Phil Yu.
And I'm Jeff Yang, and we are incredibly excited to welcome a very special guest to our studios, none other than Vivian Yoon, writer and host of a podcast we've been just obsessing over recently, K-Pop Dreaming from LAist Studios. Vivian, welcome to They Call Us Bruce.
Welcome!
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to chat with you guys.
I've been listening to the podcast, like binging it, so I've had your voice in my ear nonstop for the last couple of days, and so it's very personal. The stories yes. that you tell is very personal, so I feel like I know you already. Like coming to, like we just got logged on, and I just felt like Vivian.
Hey, what's up, girl? Let's catch up. That's so. I mean, it's so funny because like I've also known of both of you, obviously. So it's like very mutual. You know what I mean? Where I'm like, oh, I kind of feel like I already know you too. So that's great. I love that.
It's that proxy relationship you develop with somebody who's just like in your brain for hours at a time.
I mean, it's like directly into your ear, so it's very yeah. it's very intimate, right?
It when is you hear very these, intimate. Yeah.
Well, I was gonna say that's kind of what the podcast says about K-pop too, right? That part of the power of music is that it just resides with you. It becomes not just something that entertains you, but it's something you're doing when you're doing other things. It's like the constant soundtrack of your life. And that's kind of one of the most amazing things about K-pop Dreaming, in that as much as it is a history of K-pop, you know, an unpacking of what K-pop means, how it evolved to what it is today, it's also this really intimate journey of Vivian Yoon, right? It sort of talks about how you, through K-pop and with K-pop, kind of grew up. And that's actually the stuff which I found most just heartwarming and powerful about this story. And I mean, just let's jump off there. How did you get involved with this? And how did K-pop Dreaming even come to be?
Yeah, so it was actually the senior producer on the show, Fiona Ng, who works at LAist. She was the one who years ago had the idea for a podcast about K-pop. That really told the story of K-pop through the lens of like the Korean diaspora in LA. So that was like very much her brainchild. And I think she sort of had a vague idea of certain topics she might want to hit, things like trot, you know. But then, yeah, she was looking for a host. And then it just so happened that like we got connected. And the more we chatted, the more we were like, yeah, it feels like there's something real here. So Fiona really is the one who hired me. And that's really what happened. And then from there, we worked on trying to figure out like, okay, so what is this show?
I stalked you a little bit on Instagram, I will admit. But I noticed in one of your posts that you gave a shout out to our friend, Quincy Surasmith, who
yeah.
I think connected you to LAist. Am I right?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So Quincy is the one who heard that Fiona was looking for like a Korean-American writer and host. And so Quincy is the one who thought of me. And it's just because I had been posting on Instagram. Okay, so Quincy and I know each other through UCB because I was like an improv sketch person and I was on a house team at UCB on like Herald night or whatever. And so Quincy and I knew each other through the comedy scene, but then he saw these Instagram stories I was doing where I was just telling stories about my time like growing up in K-Town. And so when he heard like what Fiona was trying to do, he was like, oh, I know somebody you should talk to. And that's how he ended up connecting us. So yeah. Wait, how do you know Quincy?
Oh, Quincy he hosts his podcast, Asian Americana. It's one of the our, you know, sibling podcasts on the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Oh, right.
In addition to when you talk about people, you're just like, how do you know so and so? It's like from being Asian.
From being Asian.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That kind of thing. So
that's so
but shout
true.
Out to Quincy. He's a great guy and really appreciate it. And look, inadvertently, indirectly, he brings you to us here today. So right on.
Really, really. It really is. And I keep telling Quincy, like, I owe you. I owe you something, some food or something, for sure.
Well, I gotta say, that whole notion of, like, knowing people from just, like, being Asian, right? It's something that we take for granted a little bit, that, like, oh, of course, you know? It's almost a joke. It's like, oh, do you know X, Y, and Z? Oh, yeah, that's my cousin or something, right? In our small circle of Asian America in particular. But I actually think that one of the really kind of lovely things that you land on even early on in the podcast is the fact that K-pop actually in particular was something that made friendships happen, that brought people together. Well, that and church. Like, Korean church brings people together and K-pop brings people together. And so you have...
Korean church also tears people apart. I will say that as well.
Yes, eventually. So. we've seen both. It's, you know, you've got to unmake to make. But all that said, you talk about these two friends who actually end up being part of the audio tapestry of this. It's Sarah and Randy, I think, who you grow
Sarah
up with.
Randy.
Yeah. And for whom K-pop was kind of the connective tissue in a lot of ways, well, and Korean church, that enabled you to find one another in a time when, I mean, much like we did over the last couple of years of pandemic, we didn't have a lot of things that we could actually connect with. And it ended up being, for a lot of us, you know, visuals, Zoom, like this. But back then, Zoom didn't exist. The thing that brought people together was hearing somebody humming a song that actually was in your head at the same time. And they seem like amazing people. And I mean, the fact that you were able to bring that personal facet of yourself into this story, that's really what instantly captivated me. It's like, oh, wow, this is not, again, just a history story. It's a story of kind of your journey. So did you actually, was that part of the idea of the podcast to begin with, or is it something you brought to it when Fiona first said, hey, looking for a host for this thing?
It definitely was not part of the podcast from the beginning. I was not planning on like talking to my friends or my family at all. And so those were kind of organic discoveries. Yeah.
That's such a huge part. Like your grandma, your parents, it's like, when I say I feel like I know you. Like, that is such a huge, significant part of the narrative of the podcast. Anyway, please continue.
Yeah. No, yeah. I know it's surprising because it's like, you know, literally half of the show is about my friends and family and my personal life. But it really was like we were making really organic discoveries along the way. So for the mixtape episode, I was like, I need a way to kind of explain the fact that there are different generations of K-pop, right? Oh, yeah. Like first, second, third, fourth, and kind of explain some of the big tentpole moments so that people who aren't already K-pop fans can have a way of like, you know, everybody listening can start at the same place so that when we go into things like Trot and Seotaeji and Solid, everybody kind of starts with the same baseline understanding. So we were like, we need some kind of primer episode. And we tried writing so many different versions. And then eventually I was like, you know what? I'm just going to bring it back to the personal and just talk with my friends. And then, yeah, like map the different generations to like whatever was going on in my life at the time. Because otherwise, it's just really boring. Like, to be honest, it was just like too much information. And I felt like the only way to anchor it for me, I think when it comes to like historical concepts, it's a lot easier for me to really understand what is happening if it's grounded in the experience of one person. So I think that's what ended up happening with these like bigger concepts. I was like, okay, well, how can we anchor this in a real life situation, a real place and person, and feelings, so that we're not just like drifting throughout history. So that's kind of how that episode happened. And then with like Trot and then Moon Knight, where I talk with my grandma about growing up during the Japanese occupation and then going through the Korean War. And then I talked to my mom about like meeting my dad, who was an American soldier stationed in Seoul. Those are really organic discoveries too, because we knew we wanted to talk about Trot. And then I suddenly realized like, oh, my grandma has been obsessively telling me about the show Mr. Trot for like 2 years. This is a perfect tie-in, you know? Or, oh, wait, there's this nightclub in 1980s Seoul that was for American soldiers. Wait, my dad was an American American soldier like stationed in Seoul in the 80s. And so it really was just because we were making discoveries like as they were happening. Mm. That's how it happened.
Well, that's actually kind of the cool thing about the podcast, in the sense that it very much has talked about K-pop through the Korean-American lens. And K-pop has been universalized, much like hip-hop became universalized in a lot of ways, as something that everybody has an attachment to, that the whole world seems to have a little piece of now. But we often overlook that it did come out of not just the Korean community, but it was the Korean-American community that first owned it before anybody even recognized it. And Koreatown, right? You know, people, you end with Koreatown, but people don't really think about the fact that these immigrant communities are the crucibles in which new forms of fusion, new forms of crossover do occur, whether those you know, kind of diaspora communities are in America, like K-Town, or in Seoul, like the neighborhood of Itaewon, right? And the best way of kind of bringing those things to light is to tell those personal stories. I've got to say that the one in particular, well, okay, let's talk about Trot real quickly, because before we actually came on, I was like, I also came into contact with the idea or the term Trot from a Korean reality show, not Mr. Trot. We were obsessively watching Physical 100, and one of these super jacked specimens said, oh yeah, I am a UFC fighter and a trot singer. Like, so what is trot? And so that sent me down this rabbit hole. I'm like, why is this music called trot? I mean, it's this Korean folk music of sorts, but it's the name trot doesn't seem like it's even a Korean term, and it's not. And I found out literally through the episode that you did that trot actually references foxtrot and the particular cadence of foxtrot. So it's stuff like that that's really kind of incredible. And I don't, was this stuff that you knew already or stuff that you also were learning while you were going along?
I was absolutely learning all of the same things that, every bit of information I present is something that I learned throughout like the research process and the reporting process. Okay, but I also want to say I watched Physical 100 and I remember that moment too, because they introduce him as a trot singer first, like through the tiny little, you know, the captions they give everybody of like so-and-so car dealer, so-and-so YouTube, whatever. And I was like, how can they just drop that he's like a famous trot singer and then never address it, like never talk about it again? And I feel like the show kept doing that where they would drop like these really juicy descriptions and then never explain to us what the heck they do. And I know it was strategic, right? Because there were people who were like, you know, like there's a YouTube guy, but they said he was the CEO of whatever company he was trying to promote. Mm. And so I don't know. I just thought that was really interesting. So I remember the exact same guy and moment too, because I was like, that's a wild thing to just like never bring up again ever. It's so Korean.
It is because like, okay, now I'm sort of flashing all my Korean reality addiction colors here. But okay, like in Singles Inferno, they had the same thing where one of the contestants this most recent season is literally Miss Korea. She's like, she won Miss Korea. And she's just put out there. It's like, oh, I'm an artist. You know, I am very pretty. I was like, what?
It's so interesting, right? It's so, so interesting. Okay, I know we're like totally on a tangent, but I'm also very, very fascinated with like Physical 100 and Singles Inferno, because reality TV the American style of reality TV is so new to Korea that like here people have been studying Survivor for decades, right? Like they know the format, they know that there are certain edits for a villain, for a redemptive arc, whatever, and people go on the show knowing how they want to present themselves. But Korea doesn't have that kind of like cultural cachet yet.
Yeah.
So it's like a very different experience. And so I don't know. I just thought the whole thing was fascinating. I was like totally rooting for Sexy Yama the entire time. I didn't realize he was like raised in Japan, born and raised in Japan, but he's ethnically Korean, yeah, which is also fascinating. But now he's like trying to be famous in Korea. So when you look at his Instagram, he speaks and addresses people like in Korean and English, but he only writes his captions in Japanese.
Oh,
so it's like very strategic. Anyway, I'm also like obsessed, if you can tell. I don't know what we were talking about before this.
All right, let's wait. So yeah, team Changun Shil, by the way, I'll get ahead of that. First,
love her.
We were talking about Trot, and let me say, that is anchored by a conversation that you have with your grandmother, you know, and it totally welled up in me just my relationship with my own grandmother when I was growing up. You know, she passed away, you know, over 20 years ago, but, you know, she grew up with us, and I grew up in my household watching Korean broadcasts and videotapes of music shows, and the soundtrack of those shows was Trot, and I didn't know it was called Trot until I heard your podcast, but I knew instantly when I heard those melodies, the cadence of those songs, I was like, oh shit, like this is, and I had no idea like the history behind it. It's sort of you know, kinship with Japanese what's it called,
Enka.
With Enka, you know, and then like, but you can hear the similarities in there, you know, in that style. And I don't know, man. It just kind of welled up in me like this, like, oh, this is a part of me. Like, I never appreciated this, but this is actually, it's part of my like bloodstream right now, you know? And so that to me was like so fascinating to hear its origins and then its relationship also to Korean music and then modern Korean music. I was like, you know, there's many moments throughout the podcast where I was like, I could map my experience and my identity, my story with yours, Vivian. So I'm definitely like half a generation older than you, but there was so much in there where I was like, listening to you, there's things about I knew about K-pop and Korean entertainment and music that just didn't, I knew it, but I didn't know it, you know? And there are many instances where I was like, they should, you know, she should talk about this if she's going to talk. Oh, okay. Oh, here it is. You know, I was like, oh, you should talk about Korean music, K-pop's relationship to hip-hop. Or, oh, okay, here it is. Oh, they're going into that now. Okay. And then I was like, you should talk to, oh, I bet, you know what would be great? If they talked to Solid. That would be so, but they would never, oh, they did. You know, it's like.
No way.
Because I know Bernie Cho and Jay Chong.
Yeah.
And then I remember, and I remember when the episode about K-Con, I was like, oh, it would be cool if they talked to Angela Killer. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Like I'm friends with Angela. So I was like, oh my God, they're talking to her. So I don't know. There's a lot of things like that where I was like, oh, this is such a cool, like just a cool way of telling this, you know? And so I just felt it on a way that like, in a way that I have consumed K-pop, not in a very deep level, honestly. Mm-hmm. So, but this show kind of confirmed and shored up a lot of the interesting things that I didn't know on a more nuanced level, you know. And I really appreciated that. I'm speaking to you now as a Korean American. Like, it sort of fulfilled in a way things that I thought were kind of a vacuum or a blind spot for me. It was cool.
It like makes me kind of emotional to hear you say that. Yeah, I think the thing is, like, even for me, I didn't realize how common a lot of these experiences were for Korean Americans, like, from California until the podcast came out. And then people started being like, this is my life. This is what I went through. I had the same experiences. And it really just strengthens the idea that, like, there are commonalities that like bind communities together, you know, that's not made up, that's not imagined. Like, it's very real. And I think it's really powerful because all of those shared experiences, like, they are rooted in history and they're important, you know? And I think, like, that's something that I felt growing up, was like, somehow Korean American history isn't as important as Korean history or American history. But it is.
The podcast is structured around this larger idea that I feel like that you're grappling with, in that for you, K-pop was just kind of this thing that you secretly enjoyed. And even on a social level, it was kind of like a little bit of a thing that you only let in certain people to, like, to acknowledge that we enjoy K-pop.
Yeah.
That is a very marked difference than what is now, right? Where K-pop is consumed on a global level, massive popularity. I mean, I think K-pop fans today, young K-pop fans today, would be, like, bewildered by the fact that, you know, if I told the story of, like, when I was growing up, nobody fucking knew who where Korea was, who a Korean was. You know what I mean?
So
like,
true.
I am old enough to remember where kids would be like, are you Chinese? Are you Japanese? Yeah. I'm Korean. What is Korean? I never heard of it. Like, that's a real conversation I had, you know, in San Jose, California, you know? So that is weird. That's just a weird thing to describe, considering the penetration that, you know, like, the K wave has had across, you know, across the
world.
It's
so true. It's so true. Like, even growing up in Koreatown, like, I would get called Chinita all the time. And it's like, obviously, you know, we're not Chinese. Like, all of us live in Koreatown together, but still the default is always Chinese or Japanese.
Yeah.
And now it's changed so much. We actually have an associate producer on the show who is Korean American, but she's like younger than me. And she was sort of like, yeah, this is blowing my mind. Like, I can't imagine anyone ever having to be secretive or like K-pop not being cool or ever thinking about that. And she's just like, she's like just half a generation apart from me. And even her, she was like, I can't believe this was real, you know?
Well, so speaking for the global population of non-Koreans who are outsiders to all this and nevertheless have been sort of pulled into, the, you know, through Hallyu, all of these different things, whether it's K-drama, K-reality, K-pop and everything. It has really been fascinating to see the inversion from that perspective, right? I mean, look, I was also called Chinita or Chinito, I suppose. and I'm still called that, right? But I would say that at this point, the rise of Korean culture and identities and content and brands has gotten to a place now where there are probably more people who see non-Koreans in a lot of ways, increasingly through the lens of what Korean pop culture has manifested for them. I mean, sometimes it's a challenge. Like, let's be real. We don't all look like, you know, K-drama stars. God forbid that somebody like me would ever, you know, be as beautiful as those boys. But at the same time, it has really had huge implications for Asians outside of Korea and non-Korean Asians. It is it is something where that sort of fundamental, I won't even call it lifting of all boats, but the shedding of light on the fact that there are so many different facets of us and so many different ways to look at us that are beyond what many of us grew up with. That that's all owed in a lot of ways to the rise of Korean pop culture. And I just want to add one more thing. I mean, you kind of mentioned this, Phil, you know, the sort of historical roots of K-pop with hip hop. I just want to say thank you so much for bringing on the historian slash musicologist, the African-American woman who wrote the book Soul and Soul, right, to kind of talk about those deep structural roots of where K-pop came from out of the influence and the inspiration of Black performers, in many cases coming from Black soldiers, like African-American soldiers who were stationed in Korea. And that whole Moon Knight episode where the commensal relationship in a lot of ways of African-American soldiers and Korean-Americans who are in the community and kind of learning from one another, that was kind of, that's a story that hasn't been told, right? We only hear
about,
that
was fascinating.
Yeah, we only hear about these things from the standpoint of the tensions that arise, or the deeper and darker sort of streaks of colonialism that still, you know, are a big part of Korean culture. But that friendship, that sharing, that sense of common ground, that's something we don't hear a lot about. So that was really, really lovely.
Oh, I'm so glad you like that. Yeah, I thought that was so... it kind of blew me away when I first learned about Moon Knight, just because so many famous people from Korean music were there. Like, literally the big three were there. SM, YG, JYP, they were all there. Seotiji was there. Hyunjin Young was there. Like, the Clone guys were there. Juice, they were there. And, like, there were so many people who were there. And there were also, like, these, like, female K-pop singers that were there. And I was just like, how have I never heard of this place? Because, you know, CBGB in American pop culture history is like so iconic, yeah, and like so revered, and people talk about it all the time. Or like, you know, Madame Wong in LA. Or like
Latin Quarter in New York. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, all these places are so revered and they've become legendary, like, right? But yeah, like K-pop, it felt like it was missing. I don't know. Once I found out about Moon Knight, I was like, how have I never heard about this? You know, it's so interesting. And I'm sure Koreans like have, but it's just a matter of like, just that one degree of separation from like Asian America of not being aware of that history, I thought was really fascinating. But it's true. Also, the thing you said earlier, Jeff, about suddenly like Asian people being seen in a different light because K-pop, I've never thought about that, but that's true. Like, it used to be this dichotomy of like, you could only be Chinese or Japanese. Like, that was it. And now we've introduced like one more flavor, which I guess opens up the idea that there's like a ton of other countries that belong to the continent of Asia. I think people forget like how big Asia really is, you know? And it's interesting, like even like Southeast Asian countries get left out of the cultural conversation a lot.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't know, this might be kind of random to bring up, but there's this academic named Michelle Cho, who we were talking to and prepping for the podcast. And I didn't know this, but she was saying that it's really complicated when you look at like how popular K-pop is in places like Vietnam, because after the U.S., South Korea had the largest number of troops in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And I didn't know that. Like, I didn't realize that. And they had committed like all these atrocities, right? Yeah. And so it's just like very layered. Like, there's so much history behind the music that I just like had no idea about until listening.
It's fascinating. There is one other thing I wanted to talk to you about in terms of your, it goes hand in hand with the first episode where you're talking about sort of the thing you said secretly and very embarrassedly, like kind of listen to K-pop, and, you know, to the point where you were like listening to it and you would, you know, you would have your finger on the ready to hit, you know, to hit a strategically placed song where you're like, oh, I'm not listening to K-pop, I'm listening to whatever, I don't know, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Jimmy Eat World or something, you know. And, you know, and that was kind of the way you consumed K-pop. But, you know, this podcast, K-Pop Dreaming, is kind of an interesting thing where the mixtape, or even just, you know, telling people what you listen to, I feel like that is such a significant, huge act of vulnerability. Like, anybody telling somebody what you listen to, I mean, like, I can't think of any more sort of embarrassing or vulnerable thing where I would like, okay, here's my Spotify playlist, guys. Like, check it, you know, like, you know, that I have, like, that is unedited, and, you know, just check it out. And, you know, and then especially if I told people like what I listened to in my youth, you know, without any kind of filter, just showing people, like, I don't know, like, that is an act of a vulnerability, of true vulnerability, you know.
That's so funny. I was worried, actually. I was like, what are people who were fans of K-pop from like the first and second generation, like, what are they going to think of my song choices? Because I was thinking about including things like, you know, 난 알아요 by Seotiji and Boys, because it's so classic. But I was like, I mean, if we're being honest, I did not have a personal connection to that song, so I can't include it. So there were like picks like that where I was like, it would be really good for the history, like explaining part, but it's just not true. So I was scared that people were going to judge me. But then I think this really fun thing happened where I think people just gravitate towards like the parts that they do relate to, as opposed to the things that don't resonate with them. So people just text me and message me on Instagram being like, I loved when you talk about this band, or I loved when you talked about this singer, which I thought was really nice, you know? And I didn't realize that like MC Mong was like a deeper cut for some people. So it's just been really interesting. Everybody has their own relationship to music, you know? It's like really, really so personal. I think it's like really nice.
I gotta say, of course, not being Korean, although I am surrounded by Koreans at all times, it feels like. the songs that I first connected with in your mixtape were the Golden Age ones, right? Mm-hmm, so, you know, G, for instance, Girls' Generation, like, I remember first hearing that and saying, damn, this is just like a perfect pop confection. You know, it's impossible for me to imagine that somebody could listen to this and not feel their toe tapping, right? And then Nobody, Wonder Girl, right? The Wonder Girls. I remember actually covering the Wonder Girls when they came to America. And I actually think people don't really remember this, but so I interviewed JYP, and that guy, he's like kind of a weird guy, but also incredibly charismatic and visionary. And what he was trying to do was he was literally trying to not just bring K-pop stars to America, but K-pop, like to open a K-pop studio in America. He built sort of JYP House in New York and outfitted it with multiple floors, you know, like this is, I think, right after Rain had left him or whatever, and he was just trying to find the next big thing, and Wonder Girls was it. And I remember him telling me back then that his belief was, you know, whether or not the artists that he created now were successful in America, and he believed that they would be, of course, or whether or not even JYP's American studios took root and created a whole new K-pop industry in America, he believed K-pop was the future. And the reason why wasn't actually because of the music or the talent, although he, of course, said, we have, you know, we have all this talent that is undiscovered. And it is, again, as many people have said throughout the history of inclusion and diversity, it is not for want of talent, it's always for want of opportunity. If people were just to listen and hear us, then we would succeed. But he actually said the two things that make K-pop the future of music was, one, hard work, right? Because Koreans appreciate hard work almost as much, if not more so, than talent. We'll like start with anything and we'll turn into a K-pop star almost. And then the second thing was the business model, because he said that K-pop had long since gone past this world where people were selling physical objects, discs and albums. It's like, those are just souvenirs to us, he said. People are making money through other ways. There are streaming platforms, but also we're creating brands. And it's the brands, actually, that are the value. And then when you talk about how BTS basically allowed Big Hit to go public and is worth billions of dollars, it's not because they sold a lot of records. No one knows what a record is in Korea. It's because they created these incredibly powerful brands that are much bigger than even the individuality of the stars, the artists themselves. So it was kind of like amazing to hear in your podcast, in some ways, all of the dots that had to be filled in to get from that moment of talking to JYP to today, where actually all of that came true, you know? It's mind-blowing to me.
That's really interesting.
You talk about the four phases of K-pop, and a lot of what you talk about is the sort of road to today. But what do you think has made K-pop so incredibly successful? And why is it resilient? When people thought it was just a fad, how is it that it's just lasted so long and continued to be such an incredibly important genre?
I have no idea. I think it's like a very complicated answer, and people like much, much smarter than me who are actual like K-pop academics can probably point to a million different things. For me, the big things I saw were the rise of social media and the increased power of the fandom that happened around, you know, 2015 as like Twitter became like such an integral part of fandom. Also, there was this like music competition show called Produce 101, right? Mm. That came out in Korea, and it was like the idea of the show was that fans could produce their own K-pop group, so they could like vote every week and like send their favorites like to the top, and then they would become an eventual group. And they created like a girl group and then a boy group, 101, and then
was this called? Kepler also?
Yeah, IOI.
Yeah.
So like it was a whole thing, and I think that happened around the same time that like polls and things were getting big on Twitter and social media, and then all of a sudden like fans could start voting for their favorite artists to win awards or get exposure on the radio and things like that. So like all of this was happening around the same time that increased like ownership and actual like power from fans. So I think that's like one thing. But I do think the JYP and brand thing is really interesting, because something that we didn't get to talk about is Isuman as much. And he was like the founder of SM Entertainment. Oh, he was the creator of like the first idol boy band group H.O.T. But he actually took inspiration from like American boy bands and groups, but also people like Bobby Brown and Michael Jackson earlier than that. And he took from the Japanese idol trainee system, right, to like create K-pop. And from the beginning, he was sort of like a Steve Jobs kind of guy, where like, he didn't invent the computer, but he invented the way that people thought about the computer and like turned it into the system. And so that's sort of what he did for K-pop, where he took an engineering approach to it. And he actually, I think, studied engineering at Cal State Northridge or something like that. So he like brought this very like scientific approach to K-pop and like established a formula. So I think there's a lot more like thought that goes into it than people who aren't fans of it might think, which was me like 2 years ago before I started working on this podcast. Like I had no idea like the depth behind the genre, because I would never have called myself like a K-pop fan before.
It's funny hearing you mention the Cal State Northridge connection, but like sprinkled throughout the podcast, like when mentioning personalities in Korean pop, like there's always somebody who is like he used to be a DJ in like, you know, in Fullerton or something, like, or like things like that, where like people are like have these weird little American connections, like, oh yeah, that superstar in Korea, yeah, he used to just be, you know, he used to be a dancer in like, you know, K-Town or something like that, you know. So there's all those like just, you know, you do a good job of like connecting, like there's always been kind of this connection with Korean Americans and in America, and you know, and people doing the stuff here, that is connected back to sort of the larger diaspora, and then also to the industry in Korea. And I really appreciated that, because I felt like it connected me and then, you know, by extension, sort of the Asian American community, you know, who we have always, you mentioned this in the podcast as well, but like we're always looking for representation, striving for things to connect to that look like us, that reflect our experiences, and that for the longest time has not been present. And for a lot of people looking to K-pop, but also dramas and, you know, Korean pop culture in general, has been the way we've been able to see ourselves in some, you know, fashion by trick of the light, you know, on screen, you know. So that's been a really interesting way to look at Asian Americans, Korean Americans' kind of relationship to Korean pop culture.
Yeah. I mean, there's that joke, right, where it's like Kevin Bacon and the 6 or 7 degrees of separation or whatever, but for Korean Americans, it's like literally one. Like, you know, a guy who knows the guy you're thinking of. Like, we all just know each other. We're just one person away. I think that's really true. And the thing you're talking about with representation, this was in like one of the drafts for one of the scripts of the podcast, and like it just didn't make it in. But at one point during the Solid episode, right, these Korean American guys who are the first group to make it big in Korea, I talk about the importance of representation, because it can literally mean the difference between somebody going after a dream or not. You know, like I had all these secret dreams when I was growing up, all these things that I wanted to do that I didn't tell anybody about. So ever since I was like a little kid watching Nickelodeon or Disney Channel, like I wanted to be on TV, but there's like no little Korean girl on all that. So I'm just like, well, there must be a reason for that. Like that must not be meant for me. Mm. And then all these different spaces, not seeing people like you, like there was no pachinkos, so there was no like Korean American, like famous novelist. There was no radio personality, like nothing. So it wasn't until I was in my 20s, my early 20s, and somebody took me to go see like a really tiny, like it was like a Second City improv show, but Steven Yeun was performing. Mm. And this was like, he was on The Walking Dead, but he wasn't so famous that people would like mob his show.
Yeah.
So I went, and when I saw Steven on stage, like, I didn't see somebody doing something wildly out of reach. I saw somebody who was from my community who looked like me doing something that looked really fun that I wanted to do. And then after I chatted with him and he was like so nice and encouraged me to go for it. And then I signed up for my first improv class and that's how I got into acting and writing. It was just through seeing somebody doing the thing that I wanted to do who looked like me that made it feel possible. You know, all of a sudden it's not out of reach. It's so doable. So I think what you're talking about, Phil, is like so, 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 so true.
The most amazing thing to me about K-pop is that it is so recent, right? It is so much within our lifetimes that it didn't exist before you grew up as you were coming of age, or, you know, middle school, et cetera, was kind of the earliest days that K-pop even existed as something like what we know it. So the first pioneers for all that stuff, they're still here, right? It's not like, you know, it's not like something where we're talking about, I don't know, classical music or something, or you know, Beijing opera or whatever. You know, forms of creativity whose historical record is deep enough in time that it seems almost mythical. We know the legends. The myth makers walk amongst us, or at least close enough to us that we can still see them on TV, see them on YouTube, hear them. And I love the fact that we're finally getting to a point where a lot of this recent history, the stuff that to us is somewhere between nostalgia and history, is becoming relevant to people again. And I'm not just saying that because we wrote a book about the last three decades of Asian America, but it's because we're such a relatively recent invention ourselves, like Asian America is a recent invention, that us getting relevant in our lifetimes is something a lot of us, I don't think, even could have imagined would happen. But here we are now. And frankly, stuff like the rise of K-pop is a big part of that. So this is just such an essential listening, this particular podcast you guys have created.
Oh, thank you. And it's interesting because I feel like while Korean entertainment and K-pop has been having its moment, right, in the sun, sometimes I feel like Korean Americans are left out of that conversation because, right, like Netflix is investing so much money into Korean, South Korean entertainment, like millions and millions of dollars. And while we are seeing an increase in Asian American representation, it's nowhere near like the same scale, right? Like the shows we're talking about, Singles Inferno, Physical 100, those are South Korean TV shows, not Korean American TV shows. Mm. And I think sometimes even in talking about the podcast, like non-Asian people will ask me to speak on behalf of like, what does South Koreans think about this? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm not, I'm not Korean, right? Yeah. Like there's a difference. Yeah. And so I feel like sometimes there is also like a weird conflation that happens. And I think it's important to know the distinction of like, yeah, when you talk about Korean Americans going to South Korea to make music, like maybe don't say it's us going back home, right? Yeah. Because maybe that was never our home. Maybe we grew up in LA. Like, so I think sometimes it gets really complicated and it's kind of good to be aware maybe of that difference.
For sure. And I think the podcast is a great start for a lot of people. All right, this is a good time for us to do our favorite segment, our signature segment, the good, the bad, and the WTF. So, Jeff Yang, would you please lay down the rules of engagement?
I will. This is, of course, our roundtable segment where we take a single topic and serve it up three ways. Those three ways are the good of the thing that makes us happy inside, the bad of the thing that is troubling or frustrating or problematic, and finally, the WTF, which could be good, could be bad, could be neither. It's just a thing that's still dwelling with us, that we're still, wondering about long after the fact. So we're going to do, with our guest, Vivian Yoon, a topic that obviously makes a lot of sense, given the fact that she is the writer and host of K-Pop Dreaming from LAS Studios. We wanted to do the good, the bad, and the WTF of growing up with K-pop. And I think part of the reason we chose this one in particular is because so much of the most really interesting stuff in your podcast really is about the intersection of K-pop in your life and in your family's lives and in your friends' lives. And I think that's true for a lot of people for whom K-pop was just an instrumental part of their childhood and middlehood and teenhood experience. So let's kick it off with the good. Like, what is the good of growing up with K-pop?
Well, I can definitely say that I was like an OG K-pop fan before, you know, the third generation groove. So it gives me a little bit of cred there, which I like. But I think, you know, I've been doing a lot of reflection for the series, like in writing it, but also, you know, you think about things after. And I think it's been really incredible seeing that all of the different things that shaped K-pop, like all of the big like geopolitical forces and like immigration patterns and all those things, like the way the culture crossed over, all of those things that shaped K-pop are the same things that shaped my life. And so in doing this deep dive into K-pop history, it gave me a reason to go back and reorganize my life and look at the different phases of my life. And it gave me the chance to like rewrite some of those narratives that I had been telling myself about the way I grew up, right? So for example, in Mixtape, all of those memories that I take people through, and my ending conclusion is that like my friends were there with me the entire time, just like K-pop was there with us. That's not how I always used to view those years of my life, right? It's only through revisiting that time through the podcast that it allowed me to see that this love and this music was there the entire time. So I think that is like one really, really great thing, is that it gave me the opportunity to like make this show and then like change my life because of it and things like that. So I think that's really good.
That's awesome. That's so great. I felt the same way though, listening to it, you know, being on the receiving end of the podcast, like my own sort of Korean American identity. And then even like you, thinking about all the factors that went into creating K-pop, all on that world level, on the geopolitical level, on a historic level, how it trickled down to just like, you know, the way my family ended up in the United States and the way I grew up, like all that too. I also kind of examined and interrogated my story in really, even though I wasn't a big K-pop fan, but like looking at all that stuff, all the stuff that you present in the podcast was really eye-opening. So again, thank you for that.
Yeah. I have a question for you too, Phil. Like, you know, I personally feel like every Korean American person I know has like a pretty like painful and traumatic family history, right? Just because there's like migration things involved, and then there's like remnants of, there's just so much trauma, right, through Korean history. And I think it affected Korean culture in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of secrecy and shame and not being able to talk about certain things. And I'm like, I guess my question is like, do you relate? Do you relate to that darkness?
I relate on a level that when you talk about it, I understand. Like, yeah, I get, you know what, yeah, I mean? Like, I can't drudge up anything super painful in my own family's history, but
right,
but I have been witness to so much of that, and I in a way that like, oh, you say no more, I get it, yeah, you know, yeah, what I mean, like that kind,
yeah,
of thing,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
And we talk about, you know, you talk about Han every podcast and story and film that I have to listen to, about every documentary that talks about, you know, Saegu or whatever,
yeah,
always has to talk about Han. There's always this one line explainer about Han in, yeah, every single thing, where it's facts like, dude, I get it. Like, I just, yes, I get it, okay? You know?
You just, you so feel it, you get, you know it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like, when people make the comment or they observe like, oh, Koreans like drink a lot, I'm like, yeah, they gotta. Like, there's a reason why.
So again, as the non-Korean surrounded by Koreans at all times, I want to say that after listening to the podcast, I texted Phil. I was like, you know, somebody's just got to come out with this primer, like a list of all of the like uniquely Korean feelings and emotions that no one else can possibly understand that are related to the deep history of the culture and its experiences with colonialization and heartbreak and war and everything. And obviously Han is at the center of it. And there are a lot of terms that I've also heard that relate to things like, you know, situational awareness, nunchi, and, you know, but there's one actually you mentioned. What is this one of like sort of indescribable joy or something, which I never heard of before. And it is interesting to me because when people talk about Korean culture, there is a tendency to think about it from the standpoint of that kind of K-drama, almost sense of constant, the universe is against me and there's nothing I can do about it and I might as well die. But K-pop actually draws from other very intrinsically Korean feelings that aren't that. So it's not just about Han. It's also about this other thing. What is that term again? And where did you first come across that idea?
Yeah, it's called Hung. I think it was maybe one of the producers on our show who maybe brought it up the first time, because I obviously did that classic thing of like, well, here's Han and this is why we're like so effed up. And then she was like, wait, but there's Hung too. And I had actually never heard about it either.
Same.
But it's right. Okay. Same. But it's sort of like the yin and yang, but it's the combination of those two things that make Koreans Korean. It's not just Han. It's also like the joyful, resilient, expressive, celebratory part, because Koreans are culturally very expressive, right? Like we show our emotions on our face, like we feel feelings very deeply, like that K rage is also like a form of expression. And like somebody pointed this out to me recently too, was that there's this idea that Koreans just love to like sing and dance. You know, that thing where like certain Asian countries and families, you just grow up where if there are kids who sing, it's like, okay, sing in front of the entire family now, entertain us. And that's just like a part of the culture growing up. And I'm like, that is also very inherently Korean. And I feel like K-pop is the perfect, you know, melding of both those things. It's so true. It's so true.
It's so funny that I too had never heard of this, of Hung, right? But
yeah,
because and this idea of like collective celebration and joy over something, you know, and I was like, oh, I didn't know that that's what it was called, but I felt it. I felt it when Kim Yona won the gold medal. I felt it when
yes,
you know, during the World Cup in 2002. I felt it when Parasite won, you know, the Oscar,
yeah.
And I was like, but I see the thing is, I called that Han too. I felt like that was
yeah,
Han, right? Like because that too,
it's vindication.
All the celebration
is the pain.
Underneath the
is
celebration
the
is the pain,
yeah,
right? So I was like, yeah, oh, this is Han too. This is like a maybe, you know, Han light or something. I don't know. Like,
that's so true. I think I considered it that way too. That they were inherently like the same thing, two sides mm-hmm of the same coin, and it turns out it just has its own name. That's yeah, so true. So
well,
funny.
on this podcast, our words for Han and Hang are Yu and Yang. Like Phil is a receptacle of all the K rage and remembrance of the slights that we have received, and I'm the guy who's always like, oh, but you know what? Let's celebrate, guys. Anyway, so that said, talking about Han is a good segue, perhaps, to the darker side, and there is a darker side, presumably, of growing up with K-pop. And maybe part of it is what you already talked about, this feeling that for a long time K-pop was something you didn't want people to know that you listened to, you know? That shame of like having sort of little secret thing. I mean, hell, all of us growing up as Asian Americans have a little bit of that. We're proud at home and then we're kind of ashamed in public. I don't know if that's what you'd consider to be the bad of growing up with K-pop, but if not that, then what is?
Yeah, when I look back, like, it makes me kind of sad that that's how I felt, you know? Because part of it was circumstantial, but a lot of it was internalized. And a lot of it was wanting to, not just, like, appear white, but, like, straight up be white. To the point where I would, like, wake up or I would be doing something and I'd go to the bathroom and then I'd catch myself in the mirror. And then I'd be like shocked that I looked Korean or Asian, because in my mind I was white. I looked like the people on TV. And so that disconnect, I think, makes me really sad for my younger self, not being able to fully accept who I was because I felt like society didn't accept people like me, or mainstream society anyway. So that's probably bad. I hope other people, you know, in the future don't have to go through those things. And it's really interesting thinking about like minority versus majority and representation, and whether all of that should be proportional, like exactly to match the exact percentages of the demographics in the country or whatever, you know. And it's a really, really hard conversation. But all I know is that I'm very, very happy to have gone through this process where now I can proudly say that I am the sum of all of my experiences, the good and the bad, you know?
Is it weird now that there are like lots of non-Koreans and non-Asians who are like in reverse, kind of thinking of themselves as Korean or wanting to be Korean?
Oh, yeah. That surgery guy. That guy. That guy who just wants to look like Jimin, and he's like, I identify as Korean. I have no public opinions on that.
Oh, we have public opinions. I have nothing.
We have enough for you. Yeah. Yeah. It's tough.
It's a weird world we live in. All right. Well, here we are.
That's a great segue, actually.
It really is.
That is a really, really good segue.
We are at the WTF moment. So take us home. Tell us, what to you is the WTF of growing up with K-pop, Vivian?
Okay, so I think the thing that really stands out to me is how a lot of my friends and I, we learned how to type in Korean to try and like download songs or look at lyrics and stuff online. And it just makes me think of how like our generation that grew up with like AIM and, you know, MSN Messenger and like Kazaa and Napster and LimeWire, we're like really good at typing because we had conversations by typing. But like people older than us or slightly younger than us, they're not as good at typing, right? Like they didn't grow up with like Mavis Beacon or whatever and that being tested in schools. And it's just a different world where now kids are really good at like texting and their fingers fly with their phones. But typing is very, very unique to like that generation. And it kind of makes me sad that, or maybe proud, that we're just like so good at it. I don't know why that's like the thing that it makes me think of, but I feel like it's very, very time capsule of my generation. It's like, we're really good at typing with like both fingers on the like correct letters on the keyboard, which nobody cares about anymore.
Same.
I never thought about that.
Honestly, one of the things which actually comes out of that is the differences in mistakes people make when typing. Like when I see my kids texting me, the mistakes they're making are totally different from the mistakes I make, because I'm used to kind of like the touch typing with all hands, right? A lot of times the mistakes they make are thumb typing mistakes where it's literally because, you know, you're expecting autocorrect to go a certain way and it doesn't, and they're so used to it. Mm-hmm. So it's like adjacent words, not like just typos. It's like duck you. Not that my kids say that to me.
Yeah.
Hopefully. You know what I'm saying? And now we're growing up in an era where people are increasingly using speech to text, right? So we're going to start getting a different layer of errors, which is about people, you know, using phonetically similar, you know, sort of homonyms, right, in the place of words. It's almost like the fossil record of the interfaces we use comes out in the
typos.
The typos. Yeah. We leave behind. But
it's like when they can they study like handwriting to tell like if you're a serial killer or whatever, right?
Look at the typos. The clue, it's all there. It's all there.
Yeah, right?
No one has handwriting anymore, so whatever.
That analysis is going to happen soon.
Well, one of the things that actually pointed me to that, that AIM era thing, was when you were talking about the fact that all of your boyfriend, your kind of thug boyfriend's friends had KPX in their handles, because KPX stood for Korean power and then the X symbol here, right?
Korean pride. Korean pride. Not power.
Korean power is the gang. But yeah, Korean pride. Korean yeah. pride here. And it was a marker of like, oh, you know, I'm from Koreatown and I rep it, right? And yeah. again, no one who doesn't know that is going to reverse engineer that from looking at people's AIM handles, if those are even recorded anywhere, from the vantage point of today. So it's that kind of like recent history, you know, digging up of the strata that is so fascinating about this podcast.
Yeah, I wish we could have gone more into like K-Town culture in like the 90s and 2000s, because I feel like it was so specific with like the Tangujangs, right? The billiard places and Cyber Zone and like the photo booth places. Like, it was its whole own thing with all these like unsupervised kids just acting really tough and hard. And
I think as we have said a lot of times when we discuss our book, is that like, our book really just scratches the surface, and we wish we could spend more time on any number of topics that we talk about. Just like in this podcast, I mean, like, you know, you don't need to wish that you would have talked about this other thing, because you could have an whole other podcast about Koreatown, about these, about these things, right? Like, we could have a whole other podcast about like AZN Pride era shit. You know, like that's just it's like fascinating, right? So
yes,
all this stuff is worthy of exploration. I'm really glad that your podcast is an example of this. You know, being able to interrogate and look at, and really examine through a personal lens. This aspect of something that's very, that's kind of, it seems ubiquitous now, but like has roots, you know, has personal origins. So that's really cool. All right. We've done our three rounds.
We have.
Thank you for playing.
I want to add one WTF, by the way, that from my perspective, just because when I came across it, it really threw me hard, right? Which was just when you were talking about your mom and your mom's history as like a club girl in Itaewon in her 20s and everything, you actually dropped this little factoid that I was like, that can't be right. And it is that she talks about how the song Brother Louie by Modern Talking was what everybody was listening to in all the clubs back then. And, you know, you're talking about your mom, and it's like, oh, you know, my mom is like, you know, she's an, you know, older woman, she's in her 60s or whatever. And I'm like, how is that even possible? Like, that was the music which I was listening to at parties when I was in my 20s, and then it hit me. I'm like closer to your mom's age than I am to your age, and that is why. I'm like, holy shit.
Oh,
like,
my God.
All that synth pop stuff that I was like, oh yeah, you know, New Order and, you know, whatever. It's like, that is the stuff that your mom probably grew up with, not you. So,
or
Kim Bichu.
Oh my God.
Anyway, so I had a sad. I had a big sad right there.
Oh no.
WTF, baby.
WTF. WTF. Yeah. Right. Wow.
Well, that is our three rounds. Thank you, Jeff, for sharing that. The podcast is K-Pop Dreaming, hosted by Vivian Yoon, our guest. It's from LAS Studios. It's actually the second season of the podcast California Love. So if you're looking for it on your podcast app, search for California Love and K-Pop Dreaming should come up. Vivian, how can people connect with you, find you online?
Yeah, I'm really just only on Instagram. You can find me at Vivian J. Yoon. And that's pretty much it. I'm like really scared of Twitter, so I stay off it.
That's wise. You should. it's a garbage cesspool. Anyway, that's it. Jeff Yang, how can people find you online?
I guess I'm still floating in the garbage pool. But yeah, Original Spin on Twitter. On Mastodon, I am also Original Spin at mas.to, and I'm on Instagram, actually, as Original Spin these days. So look for me there as well. How about you, Phil? How can people find you online?
You can find me at Angry Asian Man on social media and on angryasianman.com. You can find They Call Us Bruce at They Call Us Bruce on, you know, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Vivian Yoon, thank you so much for sharing. Thank you for the podcast. It's been really a pleasure having you on. And, you know, we just thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so thrilled that I got to chat with you guys. And thank you for listening to the podcast. It's like genuinely shocking anytime like anyone listens. So thanks.
It's good.
It's very good. It's very good.
All right, everybody. Until next time. Peace.
Peace.
You've been listening to They Call Us Bruce with Jeff Yang and Phil Yu. Our theme music is by Kiro One. They Call Us Bruce is a member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian American community. Find out more at podcastpotluck.com. And thanks for listening.
And that's our show.
Like what you heard? Please subscribe, leave a review, and a 5-star rating on your favorite podcasting platform.
Now more than ever, people need to be hearing these stories. Please share our show with a friend or three.
Want to learn more or got something to share? Visit modmypod.com or email us, hi mom@modmypod.com.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter @modminpod. We'd love to hear from you.
That's it for now. I've been Ramin Segal.
And I'm still Sharon Lee Tony.
Remember, we're all modern minorities out there.
We'll talk to you soon.
Hi, this is Dr. Laurie Santos. In a world that sometimes feels uncertain, there are beacons of hope in your neighborhood. Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network. We believe that the people living all around you are your best bet at creating meaningful social bonds and preparing you for the next big weather event. Whether it's lending a helping hand to a neighbor in need or standing together in times of natural disaster, Neighbor to Neighbor empowers you to grow your community. Visit caneighbors.com to learn how you can build a more connected community. Neighbor to neighbor. It takes a neighborhood.